From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we mark the 20th anniversary of the fall of Saigon and the end of the war in Vietnam. Lieutenant General Harold Moore remembers leading one of the first and bloodiest major battles of the war in Ia Drang. David Halberstam tells us about being one of the first American reporters to contradict the government's optimistic picture of the war. Halberstam won a Pulitzer Prize for his war coverage in the New York Times. And we hear from Michael Herr, author of Dispatches, the novel considered by many to be the definitive Vietnam book. Also today, we remember Maggie Kuhn, founder of the Grey Panthers, who died last week at the age of 89. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Search teams in Oklahoma City are cautiously looking for more bodies in the rubble of the city's federal building. Forecasters say bad weather is moving in, including severe thunderstorms. These could bring high winds, lightning, and rain. Fire Chief Gary Marr says it will be an hour-by-hour situation, but he says most of the building has been searched.
We think that we have reached the bottom in both an inside and outside area, and that those two areas are not separated by very much footage, which means that we're seeing a point where we are going to, the inside and outside efforts are going to meet, so to speak, and I believe that that will cause a great speed up of the way that the rubble pile out front is reduced and worked on.
The death toll is 110. It's estimated that 90 people are missing. Meanwhile, President Clinton is urging Congress to give government new tools to fight domestic terrorism. He wants lawmakers to adopt proposals he's made since the bombing to give the FBI new powers to investigate and infiltrate domestic groups that support violence.
I have put tough legislation on the table. It reassures the American people that we are doing all we can to protect them and, most importantly, their children. We must not dawdle or delay. Congress must act, and act promptly.
Investigators are searching for an Arizona license plate linked to last week's bombing. The FBI believes the plate was on a car that suspect Timothy McVeigh was driving, but the plate was missing when he was stopped. A federal appeals court has overturned the Clinton administration's attempt to require the use of corn-based ethanol in gasoline. A three-judge panel says the Clean Air Act lets the government set lower standards for gasoline, but not to order a precise formula for the fuel. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
The court ruling wipes out a mandated market for ethanol, which is made from corn, and so deals a heavy blow to corn growers and processors. Their lobby, led by the grain company Archer Daniels Midland, for years has been doing battle with oil refiners, which prefer to blend gasoline with methanol made from natural gas. Neither ethanol nor methanol has a strong edge environmentally. But despite the loss in court, ethanol continues to enjoy lower excise taxes and other federal subsidies. This is Peter Overby in Washington.
The government says the economy grew at an annual rate of 2.8% in the first quarter of this year. That's a dramatic slowdown from the rate set in the fourth quarter of last year, which was 5.1%. The reading is a little lower than some analysts had expected. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 6 points at 43.20. The Nasdaq has risen 2.5 points to 8.43. This is NPR. Vietnam is holding celebrations to mark the 20th anniversary of the communist victory in the Vietnam War. The government honored its war heroes and heroines today with a ceremony. Several of them met with senior government leaders in Hanoi's presidential palace. The actual anniversary of the fall of Saigon, which is now known as Ho Chi Minh City, is April 30th. Vietnam is planning a weekend of celebrations. The Vietnam War killed 58,000 U.S. troops, almost 2 million Vietnamese civilians, more than 1 million North Vietnamese, and more than 200,000 South Vietnamese troops. Shoemaker L.A. Gear has terminated its agreement to buy Ryka, the cash-strapped maker of women's athletic shoes. Bloomberg's Charlie Pellett has more.
L.A. Gear Chairman and Chief Executive Stanley Gold says in light of Rika's recently announced financial results for 1994, as well as anticipated financial results for the first and second quarters of this year, it would not be in the best interests of L.A. Gear or its shareholders to continue to pursue the acquisition of Rika. Now, Rika has said that if the merger does not go through, it believes there is substantial doubt that the company will be able to continue its business. Norwood, Massachusetts-based Rika agreed to be acquired by L.A. Gear in January for about $16 million in cash and stock plus warrants to buy L.A. Gear stock. Since being founded in 1986, the maker of women's athletic shoes never did have an annual profit, although it did have a few profitable quarters. I'm Charlie Pellett.
Some 1,000 college students marched through downtown Oshkosh, Wisconsin early today. Some of them smashed windows and tore down traffic lights. Police had raided a fraternity party. About a dozen people were arrested for damaging at least 15 businesses near the University of Wisconsin at Oshkosh. Police say the disturbance began when they went to a fraternity party and began taking away underage drinkers. A false fire alarm went off in a nearby dormitory. Some students left the dorm and joined an impromptu march. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Sunday marks the 20th anniversary of the fall of Saigon and the end of the war in Vietnam. Although the war is long over, it's still being debated today. Just look at the heated reactions to Robert McNamara's new memoir. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we look back on the war with a general who fought it and writers who covered it. We begin with two survivors of the first major land battle the Americans fought in Vietnam. It was also the bloodiest. Both sides claimed victory. Both sides suffered tremendous losses. My guests are Lieutenant General Harold Moore, who led the campaign, and Joseph Galloway, who was a 23-year-old reporter at the time, covering the battle for UPI. General Moore led 450 men of the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, into the Ia Drang Valley. They never expected to be surrounded by 2,000 North Vietnamese soldiers. Reinforcements came from both sides. The battle ended with 230 Americans dead, 240 wounded, and 3,000 North Vietnamese dead. This is an excerpt of a 1992 interview recorded after the publication of Moore and Galloway's book about Ia Drang called We Were Soldiers Once and Young. We'll hear first from General Moore.
General, when bombs are falling and there's artillery fire all around and you're under attack, This is the question of somebody who's never served or been in battle. But how do you think clearly? I mean, this is the time when you are most required to think clearly, but when it must be most difficult to do so.
I really have never had any problem thinking clearly in a tough, time-critical situation. I think I kind of go into a sort of a C-zone. And blank out all the horrible brutality which is going on around me, being aware of it nevertheless, but realizing that I was a commander, I am a commander, and I am responsible for preserving as many American lives as I can and killing as many enemies as I can. Now, in the smoke and the dust, which limits visibility, and the terrible heat, that compounds the situation. The men screaming and yelling, giving orders in three languages, English, Spanish, Vietnamese. Wounded men screaming for medics and for their mother about to die. I've never found it difficult to keep my head in situations like that. I'm a paratrooper. I've had a couple of malfunctions. Once I was 8 seconds from hitting the ground, but I knew I'd make it in on my reserve if I could get it open. So I've never really been concerned when I've been in a tough situation. Just do the job.
I guess you can't allow yourself to get too emotional about your men dying in the middle of a fight.
No, you cannot. And furthermore, you cannot impart by your very manner and your voice on the radio any possible sign or word or tone of voice that would indicate to any listener or any of your men looking at you that you were rattled. You had to look cool and be cool and some you can't put on.
What about when the battle's over and you don't have to be cool and you don't have to be unemotional? Does it get you in a different way then?
Yep. That's when it's always hit me. In this battle, I looked around on the ground and saw many of my precious men in their ponchos lying dead, men whom I have trained for 18 months, knew their wives, children, many of them, knew them very closely, and I knew a terrible truth that 24 hours later would shatter the hearts of their families back home in America. And that got to me. Darn right it did. And I never a day goes by in the 27 years since that battle that I don't refight it in my mind and think about those great Americans who never backed off, many of them who had only 7 to 10 days left in the service. And they went home in coffins. And I'm forever grateful for their service, and I grieve for them forever. And for years, I felt guilty that I was not killed. I guess that's a normal reaction from a commander who loves his men.
You don't feel that way anymore?
I've kind of gotten over it a little bit. A few years back, several of my troopers told me at one of these reunions, they said, "Colonel," and they still call me Colonel, which is fine, "Colonel, you guys stop feeling that way, because if you died in that place, none of us would have got out of there." Well, I don't know if that's true or false, but that made me feel better.
Now, this battle lasted 4 days and 4 nights. Did you get any sleep at all, either of you, during the length of the battle?
I didn't get any sleep. Along about the early morning of the third day, my mind was still functioning clearly and cleanly and quickly. Do that on adrenaline or just on training and stamina. But the curious thing that happened was that I had to think every word before I would say it into the radio or to people around me. It was like translating English into English, if you can understand what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Joe, did you get any sleep, and were you functioning well?
Well, I was functioning. Sleep sort of leaves your mind. When I'd gone out to that tea plantation, I'd been on the perimeter with one of Colonel Moore's, his Bravo company. And that was foxholes and alarms all night and 100% alert, so I got no sleep that night, and I got no sleep the next night. And I think it was on the last night we were in there, somewhere about 2 o'clock in the morning, it kind of caught up with me, and I remember leaning back against a tree, and the last thing I remember for about an hour and a half until the shooting started again was I remember that same fellow who booted me up onto my feet in the middle of the firestorm, I remember him kneeling down, the sergeant major, and putting a poncho liner over me and tucking me in like I was his son or his grandchild. And I thought, what a tender gesture from such a tough man. And I did. I just conked out. I slept for a couple of hours. I was awakened by the renewed fighting and came up out of the poncho liner and went back to work. Some of that work, I would say, you're not so much a news person in those circumstances as you are of another set of hands.
Mm-hmm.
You can be of use. You can carry the wounded. You can bring water. You can carry ammunition.
Did you carry the wounded?
I did. The one memory that will never leave my mind is what they call a friendly fire incident that occurred on the second day, and we were around the command post, and someone said, "My God, look," and I looked up, and there were two canisters of napalm that had just been released by a U.S. Air Force F-100 jet, and they were coming directly at us, and his wingman was behind him and alongside, And if the first set of napalm cans didn't get us, the second we're surely going to. And I can remember Colonel Moore screaming, get him to pull up, pull up, pull up. And the Charlie Hastings, the Air Force forward controller, on the radio screaming at that pilot. The damage was done with the first two, but we could maybe stop the second plane from dropping his, and Charlie managed to do that. But the other two, just like slow motion, coming down at us, the officer next to me, he knew something I didn't know, that if you are caught in napalm, the one thing you need to do is protect your eyes. And he turned and he put his face into my shoulder and protected his eyes while I just watched them come. And they went just directly over our heads. And they struck in the middle of a couple of small foxholes where our engineer detachment were dug in the grass. And the napalm engulfed them, and we could see them dancing in the fire. And as soon as that napalm died down and we could run out into that smoldering grass, we did. And a man loomed up in the smoke, and he said, get this man by his feet. And I reached, and I caught his ankles, and when I did, the nylon of the combat boots crumbled in my hands, and the flesh came off, and I could feel the bones of his ankles in the palms of my hands. And you never ever forget something like that. Those men lay for an hour or so in our little makeshift aid station right beside us, screaming in pain in spite of all the morphine in the world. This affects you. You're no longer that. You can't be a detached observer in those circumstances. These are people who are giving their lives to save yours.
Joseph Galloway and Lieutenant General Harold Moore co-wrote the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young. Journalist David Halberstam talks about covering the war after this break. This is Fresh Air. David Halberstam won a 1964 Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Vietnam for the New York Times. Halberstam was one of the first American reporters to contradict the optimistic picture of the war which the American government was presenting to the public. He was attacked by South Vietnamese and American officials for negativism and inaccuracy. Madam News said Halberstam should be barbecued. President Kennedy suggested to the publisher of the Times that Halberstam was too close to the story and asked if they were considering transferring him to another bureau. In 1985, Halberstam told me the South Vietnamese and American governments expected reporters to be supportive.
Get on the team, get on the team. That's what they used to say. The American ambassador to Vietnam, Mr. Nolting, once turned to me, and I had come back from a particularly grim tour of the Mekong Delta, where all my sources told me that we were losing the war. And I mentioned this in passing to him once. He just got furious at me, almost physically threw me out of his office and said, you're always looking for the hole in the donut. You're always looking for the hole in the donut. The great pressure, what they were trying to do was make us be patriots. I have a rather broad gauge view of patriotism and the high levels of freedom in a society like ours. I don't think I need automatically to do what some general tells me to do. I mean, I don't need to accept his definition of patriotism. I have a lot of confidence in my own patriotism and my own intelligence. But it was very tough there. There were attacks upon our sexuality, our patriotism, our political. We were called communists. I mean, it was very nasty, and it was quite orchestrated out of the White House and the Defense Department.
Was there a reward and punishment system that was used for reporters who played the game or didn't?
Well, that was the interesting thing. They tried to, and they just didn't have any rewards to hand out. I mean, they didn't have anything to punish with. I mean, they just, I mean, what, you know, it wasn't like, that was the early days of the Kennedy administration. The Kennedys were very good at rewarding reporters. If you were, I suppose, good and talented, you got to be invited to Hickory Hill or to the White House, or that you were favored, or at the press conference, perhaps the president called you by your first name, or Pierre Salinger would have lunch with you. I mean, the magnetic pull of the Kennedy social swirl was rather powerful then. We were 12,000 miles away. We could care bleep all about whether Jack or Jackie had us for dinner. We could care less whether we were invited to the embassy for dinner or by the general for dinner. I mean, they were a distant world. Our friends were the young Americans who were out in the as advisors in the war and in the Vietnamese as well. They were risking their lives. Every time we went out, we risked our lives, and that was quite often. And the last thing in the world we were going to do is, having risked our lives to cover a story, I was not going to cover up.
What about the pressure, though, on those aides and advisors who were your sources? I'm surprised that there wasn't more pressure on them from the State Department.
There was a lot from the Defense Department. There was a lot, but they were, I think, most of them were the kind of men who were responding to events, and I think they had young men on their staffs who were getting killed, and I think you can be theoretical about a war when you're in headquarters. You can sit there and be cynical about it. I think when you're in the field and you have young men who have died and you're writing letters to their widows, I don't think you're going to lie to a reporter whom you've come to know and trust. So I think that they were willing to risk their careers in many ways. I had a great source there named John Vann, who was a colonel and in the 7th Division advising the Arvin 7th Division there. And I remember when he finally pulled him back and I went to the airport to put him on the plane back to America. A whole bunch of us who were reporters gave him a little silver cigarette tray with his name. It said John Paul Vann, good soldier, good friend, and we all signed it. I think there's 5 or 6 Pulitzer Prize winners on that signature. And I remember talking to John, and I said I was nervous that my reporting was going to hurt you. And he gave me a very flinty look, and he said, "You never hurt me anymore that I wanted to be hurt." So they knew what they were doing.
My guest is David Halberstam, who won a Pulitzer Prize in 1964 for his reporting from Vietnam. What were some of the stories that you wrote that most upset or irked American and Vietnamese officials?
Oh, it was not any one story. It was, although there was a couple stories I had that about the decline, the military decline in the Mekong Delta that really drove them crazy. It was a cumulative thing. With President Kennedy, for instance, it was that my reporting day in and day out on the front page of the New York Times reflected a first-class foreign policy failure. I mean, he was enraged by it. By the end of his life, in the last couple months of his life, the whole thing was unraveling, and my colleague and I, Neil Sheehan, had just such good sources that we had that country wired. He used to complain about me, and then he would also complain to Arthur Schlesinger Jr. that he could find out more in my stories than he could from reading the State Department cables and from the military cables. And then there were a series of stories on the Mekong Delta, on the military decline there, that they just went crazy about. Kennedy really, I think, believed them, and he sent the military off to sort of come up with their view, and they sent a hot young brigadier general named Dick Stilwell out to sort of word-by-word challenge my stories. And, I mean, he was a real handler on that one. In his version, the war was being won. He challenged every single word in my stories, and unfortunately, as the Pentagon Papers later made clear in one of their reports, my version was a good deal more accurate than his. But it was the kind of politics. I mean, I was running up against the politics of the American Defense Department.
Kennedy called your editor at the Times and suggested, you know, maybe they were thinking about transferring you, maybe you'd gotten too close to the story.
Yeah. Well, that happens whenever you are giving people. I mean, Kennedy was never worried about anybody being too close to the story if he was getting his version.
What was the Times' reaction to that Kennedy request?
Oh, they were very good. I was supposed to come on home leave about then. They asked me to delay it for a couple of months, so they didn't want to look like they were acquiescing. They were quite good in general. I mean, they were made nervous by it, but they stood by me pretty well.
David Halberstam recorded in 1985. He's now working on a book about the lunch counter sit-ins of the civil rights movement. Michael Herr helped shape our collective memory of Vietnam.
Huey's over there. Lots of Huey's.
Let's have a look, Chief.
It was the air cab, first of the night.
That's them.
Our escorts to the mouth of the Nung River. But they were supposed to be waiting for us another 30 kilometers ahead. Well, air mobile. Those boys just couldn't stay put.
Michael Herr wrote Martin Sheen's voiceover narration for the film Apocalypse Now. Herr also wrote the screenplay for the Stanley Kubrick film Full Metal Jacket. Herr's 1977 novel Dispatches, which described the experiences of young men fighting, was one of the first and most important novels about the war in Vietnam. Herr was in Vietnam in 1968, covering the war for Esquire. In 1990, I asked if he thought there was a certain language that came out of the war.
There certainly was a complex of American voices that I took away from the place that played in my head for years, echoed, you know. The voice of, it was a largely adolescent American voice that had been exposed to such extremities of endurance and horror that it had a strange elegance and nobility about it.
Well, you really gave a sense in Dispatches of the war from a soldier's perspective.
Well, you know, it's my feeling, it has always been my feeling, that language is probably the most powerful thing there is, except maybe for mind. Language is the most potent force in the world, and that all of our troubles really come from bad language, that things are ill-seen and then they're ill-said, and that we walk around with received language coming out of our mouths all the time, secondhand definitions. So I try to be sort of punctilious about my language. I like to keep it close to the bone.
Dispatches and Apocalypse Now were, I think, in terms of like American literary and film culture, the first book and movie to really make the connection between the war in Vietnam and rock music as the constant soundtrack. When did you start to realize the role that rock music had in people's lives who were fighting the war? I mean, I can think of a scene in the beginning of Dispatches where you're talking about how people like took off their ponchos and the smell of like festering flesh came across the air. And you're hearing Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs singing Little Red Riding Hood.
You didn't really have to be an astute social commentator. You know, I mean, it didn't require a Tom Wolfe's eye and ear because every place you went, there were guys with transistor radios or cassette players. And it was as though, the Vietnam War had been scored by Motown and Phil Spector and the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix. And there was a way in which I came to feel that the war and the music were both coming from the same fountain, you know, the same impulses in the culture and that were in the air were manifesting in this place together, a violence and a kind of a beauty all at the same time.
Are there records that will set you off thinking about Vietnam when you still hear them now?
Only if I hear them by accident. You know, if I programmed a piece of music, it wouldn't have any effect on me. If I'm driving around in the car and a piece of music comes on, you're gone like a rocket, you know. You have no time to defend yourself against that connection. And then it can remind you.
Which records do that to you?
Anything by Jimi Hendrix will do it, you know.
Writer Michael Herr recorded in 1990. This Sunday marks the 20th anniversary of the end of the war in Vietnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Older Americans lost an ardent and eloquent advocate last weekend with the death of Maggie Kuhn, founder of the Gray Panthers. Coming up, we remember Maggie Kuhn with a 1989 interview. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the latest work of composer-conductor Pierre Boulez. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Oklahoma City Fire Chief Gary Mars says bad weather is headed for his region. High winds, heavy rain, and lightning are forecast that could hamper search teams in the bombed-out federal building. 110 people are dead. It's estimated 90 people are missing. Fire Chief Gary Mars says once the storms reach the city, it will be an hour-by-hour situation. He says teams are progressing, despite the fact the search has been held up in one area to support a loose concrete slab. Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kosarev told a news conference today his country will go ahead with a sale to Iran of one or more nuclear reactors, UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
Despite strong criticism from the United States, Kosarev said Russia plans to proceed with the transaction. He said Russia would not give Iran or any country nuclear weapons technology, and he asked why Russia should not provide several reactors under international safeguards.
International Atomic Agency guarantees, which cover not only this deal, but also all the nuclear activities of Iran.
He asked pointedly how this deal differs from the similar reactor America offers North Korea in return for restrictions on the entire North Korean nuclear program. Pi Chamberlain, Washington.
An independent pathologist says a Palestinian prisoner held by the Israeli army was tortured to death. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The Scottish pathologist told Israel's army radio that he had no doubt whatsoever about the cause of death and that 30-year-old Abdessemed Harizat died of torture. He was the first Palestinian to die in Israeli custody since Israel relaxed interrogation rules for its Shin Bet security forces last year. Israeli officials insist these rules do not permit torture. Human rights groups say they do. An Israeli security source said Harizat was a senior member of the military wing of the Muslim militant Hamas. A Justice Ministry spokeswoman said they have not yet completed their investigation into the incident. Meanwhile, an Israeli general was quoted in a newspaper today as saying that his troops must kill more wanted Palestinian guerrillas in the West Bank. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The former treasurer of Orange County, California, is facing the possibility of 14 years in prison. Robert Citron's actions as treasurer led the county to file for bankruptcy. He's pleaded guilty to defrauding investors. His choice of investments led to losses of $1.7 billion. Prosecutors say Citron will stay free on bail until an investigation is finished. Citron is cooperating in the probe, which is also focusing on the main brokerage he used, Merrill Lynch, and the role it played, if any, in the collapse. The county is suing the brokerage, claiming it failed to provide Citron with suitable investments, letting him make huge bets on interest rate swings. On Wall Street, stock prices moved up today. The Dow gained 6.5 points to close at 43.21. This is NPR. It's been a year since leaders of Native American tribes met at the White House with President Clinton. Leaders of more than 100 Native American tribes are gathering in Washington again. They're attending a day-long private meeting, with senior Clinton administration officials. Some Indian leaders say the concerns that President Clinton mentioned a year ago have not improved living conditions on reservations. They say the Justice Department and the administration have made progress, like naming officials and to specialize in Indian affairs. Michael Jordan returns to the NBA playoffs tonight. Fans will be watching to see if he can lead the Chicago Bulls to yet another championship, despite news that one of the men accused of killing his father has decided to plead guilty. Kathy Merritt reports.
After a 17-month absence from the NBA, Michael Jordan has led the Bulls to 13 victories in 17 games. They'll carry that momentum into tonight's first-round matchup with the Charlotte Hornets. Jordan's return to his native North Carolina was expected to be a happy one, but yesterday one of the men accused of murdering his father made a surprise guilty plea. Larry Demery admitted killing James Jordan in Lumberton, North Carolina in July 1993 and said he would testify against his co-defendant in the case. Both men could face the death penalty. In an interview with cable network ESPN, Jordan said he doesn't care if the two get the death penalty and what sentences they receive won't affect the way he plans to live his life. Teammates say they hope the news won't affect Jordan's playoff performance. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Merritt in Charlotte, North Carolina.
A federal appeals court has dealt a blow to corn farmers hoping to sell their crops to make ethanol. A three-judge panel has rejected federal rules requiring the use of the corn-based alcohol to make gasoline burn cleaner. The judges say the Environmental Protection Agency has the power to set standards for cleaner gas, but the ruling says the agency doesn't have authority to mandate how producers meet those standards. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After devoting 25 years of her life to challenging stereotypes of older people, Maggie Kuhn died of a heart attack last week at the age of 89. She was internationally famous as the founder of the Grey Panthers. Her vision of the group started taking shape in 1970 when Kuhn turned 65 and was forced to retire from her job with the United Presbyterian Office of Church and Society, where she was program coordinator in the Division of Church and Race. Sorry to be forced to give up her work, she formed the Grey Panthers with several other retired friends. Their goal was to build an intergenerational movement that would work to stop ageism and campaign on behalf of peace and social justice. At its peak, the Grey Panthers had 100,000 members in 32 states and a half dozen countries. We remember Maggie Kuhn with a 1989 interview.
What are some of the ways that you think older people are patronized by people who mean well?
Well, we become wrinkle babies instead of the elders of the tribe. And we are isolated. There's senior centers and senior services. And the RARE Center puts old and young people together and does not violate the continuum that life is. We're all aging, and the aging process begins with the moment of birth. And it continues till rigor mortis.
What advice would you give us all about expressions that sound like they're really flattering, but are, like, really insulting? Do you know what I mean?
Well, you see, I think we've, with senior centers, or seniors, and teenagers, I like to think of ourselves as older Americans. And I call myself an old woman.
What's wrong with senior?
Instead of senior, that's a euphemism. It's denial, in my view. But, of course, it's caught on so widely, and it's hard to get it out of the language.
Now, you started the Grey Panthers in 1970 when you faced mandatory retirement. Yeah. How did you feel when you had to give up your job?
I was very depressed and sad because I loved what I was doing. And the mandatory retirement rule I tried to avert, but it was not possible. It was pretty rigid, particularly for women. And so with five of my friends who were in the same predicament, we organized the Consultation for Older and Younger Adults for Social Change. And a television producer in New York said, "You're never going to get anywhere with that name. You're the Grey Panthers." And we said, wow, that's Ross. And the Black Panthers and the Grey Panthers had close collaborative efforts in those days. And we decided that the issue that we were going to take on was the war in Vietnam, to stand with the draft resistors, to demonstrate in front of the draft boards. That's what we did. And that gave us an immediate entree to young people.
Well, it was interesting. When you started the Grey Panthers in 1970, it was the height of the youth movement.
Yes.
So I think it must have been a challenging time to unite older and younger people.
It was, but around the issue of the war in Vietnam, there was an immediate response.
It was 20 years ago that you started the Grey Panthers. You've changed since then. I mean, you're getting older since then.
Yes.
And what is your health like now?
My health is not as robust as I would like it to be. I have arthritis in both knees and in my hands, and I have great difficulty walking sometimes. I use a cane, and this makes me a member of what the French call l'âge troisième. You know what the third age is. When you can't get along on two legs, you need a third leg. The cane is my third leg.
Do you have to pace yourself differently now than you did a few years ago?
I do, yes. But I have an idea that, in fact, I've tested this in my own life and in the lives of my contemporaries, that when one has a goal, a purpose for living, that we can do a lot of things that we could not do without a goal. And we are reinforced by our own history. We have self-esteem. Kind of a sturdy self-esteem, because we've been through a lot of changes. And we're not going to be too worried about them, because we'll be able to cope with them.
I'm wondering if you ever feel like you have to push yourself past the point that you'd like to prove something to all the people who admire you so much and who look up to you and to look to you as a role model.
Well, it's an enormous challenge, Terry. And it's humbling, too, because I can't do all that I would like to do, and it may be expected of me. But it seems imperative now in our organization to build a strong intergenerational movement to involve large numbers of young people who will carry on. When those of us who are old in the movement become too frail and die. So if we're going to survive and continue to be advocates and to work for social change, peace, and justice, we have to reach out.
I'm wondering if you are angry at certain physical ailments that you have, or
yes,
if you just feel like, well, that's part of getting older. I mean, what's your emotional response to it?
I'm ambivalent about it. I'm glad I've survived, and I'm eternally grateful and privileged and blessed that I'm able to do what I can do. But I do get really frustrated and angry that I can't get up without getting dizzy. That if I forget my cane, I'm in bad shape. And those physical difficulties have to be overcome and dealt with and lived with. And I have to deal with my anger and submerge it to a goal that I believe in that is affirming and hopeful, and move on from there.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Maggie Kuhn, the founder of the Grey Panthers. She died last Saturday at the age of 89. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1989 interview with Maggie Kuhn, founder of the Grey Panthers.
You were never married, never had children. Now, this is a fear that a lot of people have, growing old alone. And I'm sure that one of the things people look to their children for is companionship and support when they get older. Now that you're older yourself, do you have any regrets about that? And
when people ask me why I never married, I say, I just was very lucky. Because I had a number of great love affairs, which I've enjoyed remembering and writing about. And I have a family of choice that has been a part of my life. And for the last almost 30 years, I've shared my house with a variety of young people. Many of them have been students. And some have lived with me for a long time.
I think a question that a lot of people who also don't have children will have is, were you ever sorry that you didn't have children? And you're always sorry about what you didn't do, everything you do in life. You could have had an alternative and done something else.
Yes.
But some of those regrets are so deep that, that you really wish you'd made a different choice. And others you just live with.
And I have just lived with that, Terry.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have children of my own, but I have other children who are mine by choice. I'm very much interested in the young people of our neighborhood and the babies of the young children of former housemates. They mean a great deal to me. And that contents me and gives me joy.
Many people are very afraid of aging. Have you ever been afraid of getting older?
A bit. And I don't lie about my age. I brag about it. But I am afraid of further physical deterioration and the lack of ability to speak, to read. I have failing vision. And there is a gradual deterioration of physical structure. But fortunately, my mind is still alert.
Is that what scares you the most, though, the thought of losing some of your mental faculties?
Yes. And one of the reasons why I'm very concerned about mental health and the new healthcare system is that we need to know, right along, physicians and all other people in the health field need to know about the way in which bodies age and the way in which certain diseases, if not detected and treated, will result in irreversible brain damage. Now, that's inexcusable. We need to know. And when you think that more people are living longer than any time in human history, that you've got increasing numbers of people in their 90s and into their hundreds, we've got to find new ways in which we can maintain the maximum health, holistic health of the body, the mind, and the spirit, until closure.
Do you find that you can talk to younger people about subjects like death as easily as older people?
Not always.
Yeah.
Not always. And you can't always talk to older people about it.
Well, sometimes you don't know how to react when somebody brings it up. You don't know if they want to be reassured that, what are you talking about? That's not going to happen. Or whether they really want to talk about something that's been on their mind. And you don't know what your response should be, you know?
That's precisely the case. There's a denial of age and aging and a denial of closure. It's part of life.
Maggie Kuhn, founder of the Grey Panthers, died last Saturday at the age of 89. Our interview was recorded in 1989. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, on today's program, we'll be hearing about racial hatred on the Internet, actually on the World Wide Web. We'll also be hearing about a play called Gate of Heaven, about a survivor of the concentration camp at Dachau that was liberated 50 years ago, and his friendship with the Japanese-American soldier who rescued him. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about the fall of Saigon from a Vietnam veteran whose buddy was one of the helicopter pilots who was evacuating Americans and some Vietnamese from the embassy roof 20 years ago.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. At age 70, composer-conductor Pierre Boulez is suddenly a phenomenon. He's been re-recording his basic repertoire for his new label, Deutsche Grammophon, while Sony, his old label, has been re-releasing his memorable old recordings in a new Boulez edition. He's also been making numerous public appearances in the United States. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has for years been wishing for something just like this to happen.
A decade ago, Pierre Boulez was saying that he wanted to spend less time as a conductor and devote himself to composing. Now, on his 70th birthday, he's returned to conducting almost full-time. 2 years in a row, his new discs have won Classical Recording of the Year Grammys. It could almost give the Grammys a good name. It used to be practically a full-time job defending Boulez from his detractors. Now he has to be defended from his admirers. The conductor, who used to be called cold, analytical, an elitist, has suddenly become sentimentalized as the grand old man of 20th century music. But his radical approach may still be just as misunderstood. A recent article in the Sunday Times referred to his long out of print but just reissued 1967 recording of the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique as sabotaged by a perversely slow march to the scaffold. Like Otto Klemperer, another great conductor often attacked for his slow tempos, Boulez is neither perverse nor willful. His unorthodox tempo gives Berlioz's nightmare of being led reluctantly to his own execution a terrifying, grotesque power. Rejecting hand-me-down tradition, Boulez finds the heart and soul of this astonishing music. Boulez is always rethinking. His latest recordings are mostly new versions of things he's recorded before, such as his fascinating new performance of Debussy's study in eroticism, Je. In Nijinsky's original choreography of Je, the game the title refers to was a sexually charged tennis threesome. There are also pieces new to the Boulez discography. We finally have his first complete commercial recording of a Mahler symphony, the Tragic Sixth, with the Vienna Philharmonic, Mahler's own orchestra. I think Boulez is the greatest Mahler conductor of the generation succeeding Klemperer and Bruno Walter, Mahler's own disciples. This symphony can often seem lugubrious or melodramatic, but under Boulez, it's lean, driving, driven, and even satirical. The opening march has a spring to its goose step. These are Viennese soldiers, after all. The love theme is airy and youthful, not soaked in bleeding heart on sleeve. Thank you. Then Mahler superimposes the two themes, so the soldiers are marching to the love theme. Boulez makes thoroughly audible the devastating irony of this juxtaposition. Boulez recently played a 70th birthday weekend in New York with the London Symphony at Carnegie Hall. I got to two of the three programs. The clear and forward acoustics of the legendary hall are perfect for Boulez. You really could hear everything without the help of sound engineers. And the orchestra fulfilled his every wish. At 70, Boulez hasn't lost an ounce of energy. He conducted some of his own music and demanding works by some of his favorite Frenchmen, Austrians, and Russians. I'd never heard him in a live performance of his signature piece, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. The cool, analytic, elitist conductor knocked us out of our seats. Boulez brought out all the sensuality, the mystery, both spiritual and sexual, the terror and awe inherent in Stravinsky's pagan Russian ritual of fertility and human sacrifice. Boulez made three indispensable recordings of it, including a new one. But hearing it in the flesh was yet another revelation. It was one of the most overwhelming musical experiences of my life.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed new and reissued recordings conducted by Pierre Boulez on Sony and Deutsche Grammophon. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.